1990, and everyone's asking the same question. Who is Darkman?
They destroyed everything he had. All that he loved. Everything that he was. Now, crime has a new enemy, and justice has a brand new face.
I was afraid that you wouldn't want me anymore.
Of course I still want you.
The good news is that I know who's behind our little troubles of late. Finish it.
He has the power to look like any man.
They're still both sons of witches!
But he is unlike any man.
I gotta tell you something about me.
He's a cockroach. You think you kill him? And he pops up someplace else.
In the darkest hour.
Julie, who's the real monster here?
There's a light that shines on every human being. But one. From director Sam Raimi, Darkman.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Random Rewatch. This is Mike. And today we are taking on the 1990 film Darkman, one of the OG, well, comic book movies. But this is a weird comic book movie in the fact that the comic books came after the movie. This film was an original concept by Sam Raimi. He originally wanted to do, like, The Shadow or Batman and was not able to get permission to do it, not able to get licensing for it. And so he decided that he was going to come up with his own character, which he did. He drew on the idea of the Universal horror films of, like, the 1930s and 1940s. A disfigured character who, on some level, was a hero. And he wrote a 30-page short story about it. And Universal was kind of interested in it, so we did a 40-page script treatment on it. And this is what he came up with, was Darkman. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of Batman meets Phantom of the Opera, so to speak. The character of Darkman, or as his real name is, Peyton Westlake, was not super powered. He did not have any super abilities other than the fact that due to the accident and subsequent medical procedures that were performed on him, he lost his sense of touch. So he could not feel pain. And because of this, he had an increase in adrenaline in his body, which tended to make him stronger than most people. But this was all natural responses. This is not, he's not, you know, superpowered. He's not from another planet. He didn't get hit by radiation or, you know, anything like that. He's just a kind of a normal guy who had been through some tough stuff, and he comes out to be this this superhero. And so it's actually kind of an interesting character, because much like Batman, Peyton does start out as being kind of a sincere hero in that he just wants to save his girlfriend and rekindle his relationship with her. And but as he moves through vengeance for what had happened to him and the people who were responsible for it, he eventually gets to this point of self-hatred, self-loathing. And it's a very similar arc to the Batman arc in some iterations of Batman. And, you know, I think that turned out to be kind of interesting. So how did this thing actually wind up getting made? Well, as I said, you know, Sam Raimi came up with the character, wrote a treatment on it, Universal picked it up. Raimi wanted Bruce Campbell to star as Peyton Westlake, because of course he did. You know, Sam Raimi loves putting Bruce Campbell in basically everything he does. And the Universal thought that at the time that Bruce Campbell would not be able to carry the movie, which is kind of weird because Army of Darkness, Evil Dead had already been out. They were pretty successful movies. But this is Sam Raimi's first kind of big budget, at least for the time, big budget studio film. So they didn't want to take a chance with Campbell, unfortunately, because it probably would have been great. Bunch of people went up for this. Gary Oldman, Bill Paxton, until eventually it went to Neeson. Neeson really threw himself into this. He really wanted this character to be multi-layered and in-depth. He spent a lot of time at the Phoenix Society, which is a support group for people who suffered debilitating burns, to find out like what their lives are really like, how people heal, how people react to having these kind of injuries. And that went a long way towards informing his performance. In terms of Julie Hastings, the love interest, Universal wanted Julia Roberts in this role. This was before Pretty Woman, before she really blew up as a big star. Raimi kind of pushed back on that a little bit. They also talked to Demi Moore, and they tested Bridget Fonda, but felt that she was too young. So Raimi went with Frances McDormand, who he had wanted to work with. For the big bad, they got Australian actor Colin Friles. I think I'm pronouncing that right. This guy, this is weird. I mean, this guy, he's got about, 100 credits or so on IMDb between television and films. And I'm looking through the list, and I don't think I've seen any of them. Like, not a single one of the things that he's been in, other than this film. The other big bad is character Robert Durant, who will actually continue on in the sequels. We'll talk about that later. Larry Drake. Now, Larry Drake was known to people at this time for playing a character named Benny Stolwitz in the TV series L.A. Law back in the 80s. And Benny was assistant at the law firm in the show, and he was developmentally challenged. And seeing Larry Drake in this type of a role when everybody was used to him as playing Benny was really kind of a switch. And I got to tell you, I think Larry Drake is probably, if not the best part, one of the best parts of this movie. He does a really fantastic job and way, way better than I think Colin Friles is, who seems very mustache twirly kind of villain. The rest of the cast is kind of a bunch of nobodies, just character actors and day players playing, you know, very generic thugs. These four are really the only real characters in the movie. There's a bunch of cameos in the film. John Landis, Jenny Aguter, who older audiences may remember from films like Logan's Run. Younger audiences may remember from films like The Avengers and The Winter Soldier, where she played one of the members of the Security Council. Also, the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan Coen, have a visual cameo in Sam Raimi's Oldsmobile, which he puts in every movie. And at the end of the film, of course, there's a Bruce Campbell cameo, because there's no way that he was not putting Campbell in the movie. You know, Bruce Campbell in a Sam Raimi movie is about as guaranteed as Greg Grunberg in a J.J. Abrams film. It's just, it's going to happen. So Raimi wound up doing like 12 script drafts for this before finally settling down to the script that they shot. One of the big pieces of this film was the prosthetics that Liam Neeson was wearing. It was a 10-piece prosthetic. He would sometimes be in this thing for 18 hours, and it really kind of makes the film. He spent a lot of time working on his diction and his dialogue to be able to speak basically with no teeth, you know, how somebody would speak without having lips and a tongue. He does a really great job at it, I think. I mean, Liam Neeson completely threw himself into this movie, and as cheesy as this film is, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but as cheesy as this film is, he is being very earnest in this film, and he is really, really trying. And I would say so is Frances McDormand, and I've seen, you know, stuff where she's come out and said after this film, like, she didn't really understand this character, or she felt that she wasn't really in a position to give a great performance. She kind of disowns this performance a little bit, and I think that's being kind of harsh. I think, given what she's given to work with and the state of the film. And I want to come out and say, I don't think this is a bad film. I mean, it may be a very cheesy and very dated film in 2024, but in 1990, this was a very groundbreaking film in terms of its effects, in terms of its character arcs, in terms of, you know, what it asked of the audience, what it asked of its characters, and the depth and the kind of the darkness and this exploration of this journey that Peyton takes through it. This was not terrible. And there is a helicopter chase in this film that I would put with anything that's in modern day. It's really, really fantastic. We'll talk about that in a little bit later, too. There was a lot of back and forth on this film over, even after it was shot, over the edits. The original editor basically quit the film because he had a nervous breakdown, because him and Sam Raimi did not agree on basically anything. They had some original... There was an original ending of the film that was a lot more depressing and a lot darker. The initial test screenings also didn't have Danny Elfman's soundtrack in it. At the time, Universal said it was the worst film they had ever tested. However, after the music was put in and after they made some changes to the edit in the back of the film, the test screenings got remarkably better. And it became somewhat of a moderate hit. We'll talk about that at the end like we normally do. Danny Elfman's score, I think, is very reminiscent of the Batman score that he had done the year before. There's a lot of very similar kind of themes in it. And I guess that kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, Batman and Darkman are similar type characters and have a similar arc. So it makes sense that the music sounds similar. All right, so that's it pretty much for pre-production. Let's hit into the film and see what we got. So I want to say, just kind of off the top, this thing is cheesy like crazy. This film is, I know it's 1990, but this is full-on 80s stuff. The acting in some of the cases is really over the top. Not Liam Neeson, not Larry Drake, not Frances McDormand. Everybody else is just kind of completely over the top in this movie. Some of the scenes are just like so, what's the word for it? Just so like typical of what you would see at that time. So it starts out in the lab, in Peyton's lab, and they're doing this work on this synthetic skin that they're trying to get to last for more than 99 minutes or whatever it is. It's like they make this synthetic skin and then it falls apart after 99 minutes. He comes to realize that's because of the light but they're using all these like really high-tech computers and lasers and you know, these almost like 3D printers, but you know, obviously those didn't exist, but like a box where the thing would just appear with like lasers and things, you know, all this really high tech stuff, but there's random Bunsen burners just like lit and sitting on counters for some reason. But that was like coding for, this is a science lab. You have to have a Bunsen burner with, you know, something bubbling, but in some cases they're just sitting on the table, just lit for some reason. And then, you know, obviously because, you know, he runs into one later and catches on fire. The effects and the graphics were very fantastical. The fact that they could model things in 3D and, you know, manufacture things using whatever, lasers and science. And it's almost like a transporter kind of effect. You know, they have this box and it just beams this stuff in. It was really kind of far-fetched, not grounded in any particular type of science, but honestly, that wasn't really what Sam Raimi's going for here. The explosion scene where Peyton is injured is maybe the most ridiculous thing ever committed to film. It's completely bizarre with this super dramatic music. You know, Frances McDormand, Julia gets her hair blown back. There's this, you know, couple of cuts of the explosion. And then there's Peyton flying through the air, obviously comped into the shot with this crazy scream. I'm surprised they didn't use the Wilhelm scream. And then he lands, you know, he lands in the river, and then there's this morph from her standing there staring to her at the cemetery wearing, you know, a black veil. It's just, it's so crazy. Check out the YouTube short. I'll put it in the YouTube short because it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it's so, such an 80s thing. But, I mean, it is what it is, and it's a product of its time. And, you know, you can't really, I guess, complain too much about it. Larry Drake, as Durant, I'm going to tell you, he was legitimately scary. He's literally a good villain, and I put him up against really kind of anybody today. His henchmen are ridiculous, but he's got this kind of pathos to him, and his bit with the cigar cutter where he cuts off, you know, the fingertips of his victims is pretty frightening conceit, and he plays it really well. It's, you know, his scenes are directed really well. So I'm going to give him, you know, a lot of props for doing that and taking this movie pretty seriously. And I think Liam Neeson really takes this movie pretty seriously. You know, these two guys don't seem to know what movie they're in and how cheesy it is and how campy it is around them because they are so serious in it. I mean, the movie's got a really kind of indie, 80s indie feel to it. There's a lot of really borderline terrible green screen, some very obvious comp shots, and there's a lot of like these kind of 80s camera conventions, you know, a lot of whip pans and quick zooms and close-up shots of like Peyton's eye or things like that. But beneath it all, it's got a story that really has a lot of heart to it, and a lot of depth to it. You know, Peyton really goes through, you know, like I said before, this kind of journey from being, you know, sincere to moving through this revenge stage where he's just obsessed with getting back at, you know, the people who did this to him and the people who destroyed his life. And then eventually getting to the part where he just kind of hates himself and can't believe that Julie would love him. And it's really moving the way he does it. I mean, Liam Neeson, like I said, he plays it very seriously. Given the fact that he's in all this makeup, and given the fact that he's sometimes given ridiculous dialogue to say, he says it with real emotion and a real depth to it. So, I mean, props to Liam Neeson for that. He just, you know, is really bringing his A game in this film. And it's early Liam Neeson before he got to the old man punching things and shooting people Liam Neeson that we all pretty much know today. You know, the man with skills. You know, this is a different actor and one who's really, I think, trying to prove himself and really trying to take his craft seriously. And he really kind of pulls that off. You know, there's a couple things that are kind of convenient conventions in the film. I mean, the way this guy winds up making masks, once he figures out what he's doing, he's faster than Benji in Mission Impossible. I mean, he's just whipping these things out like crazy. Absolutely perfect masks of all the villains and all the bad guys that he passes out for. And at the end of the day, you know, the big plot of the big evil corporate guy is it's just a real estate scam. I mean, that's kind of a bit of a letdown maybe, but I mean, it is what it is. The one I think really great part of this movie, and I've said it before, is this helicopter scene that they have. I mean, it probably shouldn't work. It's a lot of flying around over LA with, sometimes I think it's a stuntman, sometimes I think it's just a dummy hanging from the copter, intercut with some really bad green screen, overlaid by some Danny Elfman Batman leftover music. But somehow it works. It's thrilling. It's compelling. It's kind of hilarious as well. It's really, I mean, I think it's like the best part of the movie. And it was honestly kind of, you're sitting on the edge of your seat kind of watching this, even though it's so horrendously fake. Just when they do the cuts to Larry Drake or they do the cuts to Liam Neeson, you're just sucked into whatever it is that's going on. So props to the whole crew for putting that whole thing together. And it kind of looks like almost one of these things. It's like, maybe we didn't exactly ask for permission because they're flying really low through some buildings. But it's really, I think it's like the best part of the movie. So this film had a $14 million budget. I said that before. It's Sam Raimi's first, quote, big budget studio film. It did $8 million in its opening weekend. It wound up with $48 million at the box office. So in its day, it was pretty much a hit. It spawned a 3-issue comic adaptation and then its own series of comics. There was a video game with Halloween costumes, action figures. There was an Ash Williams Darkman crossover comic. So there was a lot that came out of this. It was on TV a lot. It was on cable quite a bit. It's got an 83 on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got 65 Metacritic, C+ on CinéScore. Siskel and Ebert. I don't think either one of them reviewed it in their newspaper things, but it did make the show, and they gave it 2 thumbs up. Both of them actually really liked the film. I'm going to be honest. I kind of liked the film. And it spawned a couple of sequels. Darkman 2, The Return of Durant. Somehow Durant survived. And Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die, which were Liam Neeson was replaced by Arnold Vosloo. South African actor, you may remember him. He was the titular mummy in the mummy films in the 90s. He was in Blood Diamond. He's been in a bunch of stuff. So he takes over the role of Peyton in the sequels. So that's it. That's Darkman. I don't hate it. There's absolutely no reason that I should like it, but I kind of did. I kind of dug it. Having not seen it and 20 some odd years, if not more, it was almost like watching it new, and I really enjoyed it. So you got a couple hours to kill in an afternoon, you see it on or whatever, just pop it in. It's like mindless entertainment that's, it's good to laugh at and also enjoy a little bit of time. So let's run up the random number generator, and we are going to do next time 2002. Okay. Well, as much as I would love to do the Two Towers, I'm not going to, and I will absolutely not do Attack of the Clones. There's really only one choice here, but you're going to have to tune in to see if that's actually what makes it. But I think there's really probably only one choice for 2002 for this particular podcast. So thanks for listening. Be sure to check in with our other episodes if you haven't. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, Movie Punditry, where we run shorts, and I do out-of-the-theater reviews for movies that I've seen. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.